This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Well, I have a topic that turns out to be too big for one Sunday. And I have more than one text, so let's get to those. The first one here is from Ecclesiastes chapter 8. What a nice piece of work that is, huh? It's a great book. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. It says, "When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much a man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out." Let's back it up a little bit then to this great verse that's in chapter 3, verse 11. Here he says, much like our song we sang, "He has made everything beautiful in its time." And then listen to this. "He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he, man, cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end." He can't see it all. Well, we're not done here with these texts, so let's fly on over to Job. Now, this comes toward the end of the long saga. This is kind of the end of the affair, toward the end of it anyway. Chapter 38. All the stuff has happened. You know the story of Job. But here is where he sort of finally gets his answer, such as it is, and he gets cross-examined. So here's what it says at the beginning of that chapter. "Then the Lord answered Job." You could say, "Finally answered Job out of the whirlwind." And he said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action. Gird yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it?" Now, of course, as you know, it goes on. A lot of verses after those verses in which he just goes in some detail through all these different, in this grand, you know, long poetic passage about all the different ways that the universe is, all the different aspects of the earth, asking, how about that one? Did you know about that, or were you there? But for that, and after all that, he says, sort of in concluding it, at least that section, he says, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? This is God's word." Well, these texts belong to what we call wisdom literature. There's different kinds of writing in the Bible. It's not all the same kind. Wisdom literature. Wisdom, of course, has to do with knowledge. And the important issue of what a man can know, what he ought to know, about his life and about the world, and about how he is to know those things. This has something to do with wisdom and knowledge. And this kind of writing features a lot of that topic, and things related to that topic. Now, people by nature have a lot of questions. We just can't help it. This is how we are. This is somewhat by design. We just long to know stuff. We want to solve life's riddles and problems. We want to get to the bottom of things. And that is all perfectly fine, by the way. That is all well and good. That is your nature. And there is no harm and no foul and no crime in that. To seek to know, to seek to understand. In fact, you're invited to do that. You're told. Crave knowledge. Seek understanding. Go after wisdom. Chase it down. Flag it down. Learn, grow, disciple, so on and so forth. That's fine. That's all well and good. But there is, though, a part of the pattern of the world today, which is this series we're doing about the schema of the world, things we ought to notice about our time. the dominant ways that people think and the things they take for granted that we should be aware of and that we should rightly question because they're problematic. Well, the one we're focusing on today then has to do with this business of knowledge and acquisition of knowledge and searching for knowledge and the kinds of knowledge we get and look for and its limits. Because here is the widespread presupposition of today about knowledge and about wisdom and how we get it and our pressing questions and concerns. It has to do with something we're all so well aware of that's part of our lives on a daily basis. And that is that all knowledge is presumably answerable to one supreme voice of authority. And that is the voice of science. Science, the unquestioned keeper of truth, with all of its leading experts clothed in, you know, this near infallibility in the minds of average people. You say the word scientific, and whatever claim you're making, if it gets that adjective, if it's scientific, then it's suddenly gold-plated. If it's for something to be deemed unscientific, on the other hand, is a matter of intellectual shame. This is just the way it is now. This is how it's become. So the late Dallas Willard, I like to quote a lot, such an insightful voice. Dallas Willard said, in the case today, the authority clearly is science. Science, we are told, says this or that. We had better believe it. Unfortunately, science, in fact, says nothing. Because it is not the kind of thing that can say anything. Only scientists say things. And scientists can be remarkably unscientific at times, and have often been remarkably wrong. And in addition, he says, many who would speak for science are not scientists and have no qualifications in the area of their claims. But if they can assume an aura of, quote, scientific in some way, then they will be able to rationalize at will and gain a hearing for it. Because this is just the state of affairs today. He's right. It is a magical word. Whatever your view, whatever your position, whatever your point of view or your stance or your program or your agenda or the bill you want to get passed, whatever it is, if you can just get the label scientific, then you're good. So you see, science now it's a slogan, it's a buzzword, it's a banner. It's a political tool, is it not? And you see, there's a movement. For some people who today are looking for movements. I mean, people are looking for something to belong to. And as we've said in the past, recently, the secularization of the age has sort of left people without the thing to belong to that would have been something spiritual, something more religious. But if you don't have that, you're looking for other things. You join some other cause. You need something, some higher calling. So for some people, then, they just look for what's a good replacement. Well, science. We will be pro-science. And that's our cause. That's my movement. That's my mantra. So that for a lot of people, as Willard says, they don't know much about science. I mean, they're not really trained in it. It's sort of like having the flag in the background when you talk. If you have the flag in the background, doesn't that kind of help what you're saying? How can you disagree with a man with a flag behind him? And how can you disagree with somebody if they've got science behind them? If not science in actuality, at least science as a banner. At least science as, you know, the flag they wave or the thing on their t-shirt. So then, this is what we face today. I know you know it. I know you know this is true. I see the head shakes and people. I can see the agreement. It's gratifying to know that, okay, we are speaking the same language. There is no further explanation needed on this. You live in this culture. You know that science is the be-all and the end-all now. It has almost the robes of authority that the clergy had in the high Middle Ages. You know, it's almost papal type authority. It's like, whoa, everybody, whatever the topic, whatever the issue, whatever the controversy or the debate, Everyone must hush, because the scientists will now speak. It's almost like when the scientist walks in the room, all rise. You know, it's like now the real judge comes. Even if it's way out of his or her domain, doesn't matter. They're cloaked in the authority. So I want to challenge this, and I think we should, and it will take us a couple of weeks to do so. Well, let me show you. I'll put my cards right up front here and show you that these are, then, the challenges. These are the things I want to say. I put them in five handy statements. So here they are. Some of these don't sound like challenges. I'm just stating some things that we ought to be mindful of. But they end up being challenges to this prevailing pattern of thinking in the world. So, number one, science is a specific and limited domain of knowledge. Number two, science, this one might surprise some people, is the fruit of Christian civilization. Number three, science is not in opposition to other kinds of truth. It's not science versus everything else that would yield truth. Number four, now some of these you might think, well, what does that exactly mean? When we get to it, I will certainly explain it, of course. So number four, a little longer. This fourth statement, the philosophy or worldview known as scientism is not a result or conclusion of science itself. What is scientism? Well, you'll have to wait. Number five, science cannot address our deepest questions and needs. These are the things that I'll be saying, essentially, in longer form. So let's look at some of these. And so the first one there, science is a very specific and limited domain of knowledge. Well, now to understand this, we've got to do a little definition. I do this a lot. I know sometimes people think, oh, here he goes. He's always defining everything. I'll never stop, nor will I ever apologize. If you ask me, this is not nearly enough of this. There's not nearly enough definition. People just throw words around, you know, like bad knife throwers at the circus, you know? And they're just stabbing everything, and they don't always hit their mark. And people just, I don't even know what you're talking about. You got to define your terms. So let's just understand what we mean then. Because science, like a lot of words, is used so widely. It's so elastic. Well, for this, Latin is what we need. Aha! Scientia. The term for knowledge. Often a language has more than one word for knowledge. We've mentioned in Greek before, in the New Testament, the word gnosis with a G. Right? But this is Latin, scientia, knowledge in the broadest sense. That's simply what it means, knowledge. And in fact, you will find a lot of slogans, I mean old slogans for example, universities. Some of the old universities and institutions will have this Latin term as part of their old, I was thinking of one, the one I saw on a shirt not that long ago. It said, scientia est, what was the Latin word for power? It had to be power. Any Latin scholars know what it is? I forget. I saw a shirt. That's what it was. Knowledge is power. But he had it in Latin. I thought, that's a cool shirt. I always give props to a good t-shirt. I mean, you know, there's t-shirt art is like its own sub-category of art, is it not? You know, 10-point scale for humor, 10-point scale for originality, 10-point scale for copyright infringement. Yeah. So then, knowledge. Okay, well, that doesn't help us. This, what we now call science today, was once in the early period called natural philosophy. That's what they would have called it. Natural philosophy. Now we say, well, what is the exact definition? Well, some of the scholars who study this, and when I say scholars who study this, I'm not even necessarily talking about practicing scientists themselves, because to ask a question about the nature of science and the definition of science is not necessarily a scientific question. Well, how can that be? Well, hold on, I'll get to that. There's a whole branch of study that is called the philosophy of science. Now, because I do philosophy, and I happen to know this kind of thing, and I've taught this class. I taught a class called Philosophy of Science. And so there are people who are primarily philosophers, and sometimes they have a science degree also. And they don't do science per se. They don't spend time in laboratories. They write about the issues surrounding science, the application, the ethics of it, you know what I mean? And one of the things is to actually defining it. So one of those, J.P. Moreland, who's written a lot on this, he says that in fact there is no clear, agreed upon definition for what science is. But, he says, it usually involves components like these, and this will make sense to you. Components such as empirical observation. You know what empirical just means? Through the senses, right? Like, a lot of the knowledge you get is just through your senses. One of the most basic knowledge you have. Like, for example, how about this question? Has that meat gone bad? Now, that is in some ways a scientific question, because that will involve... See, there you remember this from school? That will involve some basic empirical knowledge, won't it? I mean, if I ask, has this meat gone bad? Well, now, you could run off to a laboratory and try to run some tests on it, take it and put it under some, you know, do some chemical tests on it. Or you could examine the date and extrapolate from that. But you know what you're going to do? You're going to use those good old God-given olfactory senses you have, and you're going to make, you will render your scientific conclusion on the spot. And the look on your face may tell us before the words even come out whether that meat's gone bad. That's basic. That's empiricism. Most of what you do on a daily basis, minute by minute, is take in the world. It's the first kind of knowledge. When you're a little baby, you know, that's how you first acquire your knowledge, isn't it? I mean, you know, a little baby, little sponge brain starts to suck in and soak in everything about the world. But before that baby brain can start taking in propositional knowledge, like examining truth claims and seeing if they cohere with each other and what conclusions they draw from them, that comes later. The first thing they do for the first, I don't know, however long, what do? They're just doing data collection. Every baby is like a little scientist. Data collection. That's where you start. Observation, step one. And that's what every baby's doing. Just learning about the world in that old-fashioned way that God intended to first learn about the world, which is taking it in. That's why they stare. That's why they stare at strangers. That's why if you're on a plane and your little kids, little toddlers in front of you on the plane, he don't care about social rules. He'll stand up and stare at you. I mean, stare and stare and not stop staring. Why? Because you're new. You're different. You're a face they're not used to looking at. So they're just checking it out. That's why they taste a lot of stuff they shouldn't be tasting. But they got to figure this out. What is that? I don't know. Let's stick it in my mouth and see what it is. That'll tell me something. They're just walking around examining the world. It's great because every new animal that a little tiny kid sees for the first time is remarkable and profound. It's like, see, because you're used to the animals of the world. You've seen them. But to a little kid, to a tiny kid, maybe they don't have a dog at home, and they go to somebody's house, and that person has a dog. Just look, just the look on their face. See, because to them, that thing just walked out of George Lucas's studio. That's like some creature I've never seen before. What is this thing? This thing, it's alive. It moves. What? This is wild. So they're just captivated with it. Like if I showed you some creature you've never beheld in your life, some new species, you would be in awe about it. You would look at it for a long time. Empirical knowledge is one of the main ingredients here then. So empirical observation, the collection of data. And then models that we draw. We bring imagination to it. Hypotheticals. We say, could it work like this? This might be one way that stuff works. We don't know it yet, but this is one way it could work. What if this is how that works? And then you might devise experiments to kind of test it. Let's see. If this happens, this ought to... Every time you cook this at this temperature, this ought to happen. Let's see. Let's give it a go. Predictions that you make. People with competing theories. I'm a smart guy, and I think this might be how it works. But that guy over there, he's pretty smart, too. He thinks it might work a different way. So, we have competing theories. So, Moreland says, while there's no completely agreed upon definition of what science is, it usually involves most of those things. And I think most of us hearing that would say, yeah, that makes sense. But now, what about the methodology? You go to school. I remember this. I don't remember much, but I remember this from way back. And some of you remember from way back or way, way back, or for some of you, way, way, way back. Depends on how far back your way back machine has to travel. But you remember that you learned in school this method, didn't you? And you might have done little things where it's like, okay, kids, now let's practice a scientific method. But the thing is, you know, even this method is, while it's caught on, it became the thing, a lot of these thinkers who help us with this, they will even tell us that there's not even one clear scientific method. So, for example, the late Ian Barber wrote extensively about this topic, about science and religion and so on. And he said there is no single scientific methods. There are a lot of different methods, methodologies. They typically share a lot of the features we already talked about. So that this is what science is about. It's inductive. What do I mean, by the way, by inductive? That just has to do with the senses. Inductive learning is what the baby's doing. Over time, will a child learn over time that fire burns you? Yeah. Will he learn that the neighbor's dog, the little one with the spots, that one will bite? That you better watch out for that one? Yeah. Because he did some research, the library checked out some. No, he learned that by the inductive method. Because when you experience fire a few times, every time it's always hot. You might try it the next time. Maybe this next time it'll feel frosty and cool. Nope, 10 out of 10 times it burns. That's inductive method. We have learned a lot about the world just by repetition. That's what science does. Well, this then is, let's consider, when is a question scientific and when is it not? So this is something we have to know. We'll get to these guys in a minute. What is and what is not a scientific question? Since we want to know what it is and what it isn't. And this, of course, the reason this point is so important is because one of the problems in the thinking of today, in that way that people presuppose the supremacy of science over everything and the all-encompassing nature, and that science can answer our questions and will answer our questions and will save us all, one of the problems is that people today are very confused about what exactly it is. And so thus they think that everything, every question we have, every issue we face, can just be reduced to a purely scientific question, which is why we call upon scientists to answer questions for us that some of them have no business answering. If you don't believe that, all you've got to do is go watch some YouTube videos of the man who, when we were kids, was referred to as, quote, the science guy. He was called the science guy. He's synonymous with science. That's his brand. All right? He's sort of like, even in his spare time, he wears the long lab coat just so everyone knows. Even I think he goes to the grocery store wearing a lab coat. Like, don't forget, I'm the science guy. Huh? Why would you want to do that? Because everywhere you go, everyone yields to you. Everywhere you go, they say, oh, whatever you say, though, because you're after all, you speak for science. Go watch some of his videos where he deals with political issues, world affairs, moral questions, abortion. You'll see quickly why, wearing a lab coat doesn't give you a whole lot of wisdom on big issues. But this is a problem. We don't know what the result is. So it's foolishness. Foolish attempts to answer non-scientific questions in somehow purely scientific ways. So here are some examples of scientific questions. How about this? What is the boiling point of water at latitude 65.8 degrees north? Anybody know? Can I get a witness? I'm just kidding. I don't expect anyone to know that. I would be impressed. How about, what is the composition of the soil on the peak of Mount Hood? That's a scientific question. How long is the mating season for Caribbean bottlenose dolphins? I know you've asked it. I know you've oft wondered. How about this? What is the effect of small doses of a specific herbal extract on the immunity of HIV patients? That's a scientific question. What is the approximate distance of Jupiter's closest moon to its surface? How many nights have I lay awake pondering that? Well, look, you notice what all those questions have in common. You know, some about biology, some about the heavens, some about the human anatomy, they're from different realms, but you know that those are all scientific questions. They're what they call first order questions. They're just very specific about the world. They're discoverable by the aforementioned methods we were talking about. Those are scientific questions. Now, note the difference in those kind of questions and questions like these. What is man's ultimate purpose? Does man have a soul? What are universal human rights? And what is the nature of human value or dignity? What is the highest form of love? What is evil? Why are people so capable of such depraved acts? Why is self-sacrifice for others a noble act? You see, those kind of questions, it's so easy to sense immediately the difference in the kinds of questions I asked a minute ago and those kind of questions. But our culture will often act as if the people who are the experts in answering those first questions are the ones who have the voice of authority to answer the second group. So, Edward Schrödinger, Austrian Nobel-winning pioneer in quantum physics and wave mechanics, the successor to Max Planck, said these words, quote, "The scientific picture of the world around me is very deficient. It gives me a lot of factual information. It puts all our experience in a magnificently consistent order. But it is ghastly silent about all that is really near to our hearts, that really matters to us. It knows nothing of beauty and ugly and good and bad and God and eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are often so silly that we are not inclined to take them seriously." The words of a man who ought to know. So, as to that first question then, we see then, that first statement I made, I hope that becomes clear. Science, by the way, as a footnote here, let's make no mistake about it, my friends. We love ourselves some science. Even if, I don't care if you have thought about it much, you think you do or you don't, you love it, or at least this much. At least you love the results of all the work in the sciences that has been done for years and years and years. You love what science produces, which is, more than anything, technology. You live every day of your life with the innumerable benefits. And you know, really, the curvature of advancement in all these domains, particularly in technology, where technology has a bearing on the sciences, you realize how speedy it's been just in the last 100 years? Someone said once that in terms of technology, those who fought in the Civil War in the early 1860s were closer technologically to the ancient Greeks and people in biblical times than they were to us. Because in just that time, we've moved. It's like if you're looking at it on a chart, the line goes up, you know, it increases in terms of just numbers of new technological inventions. And in the last 50 years, it's just spiked. So, you know, you got this thing in your hand, it does all this stuff, it wakes you up in the morning, gives you the news, gives you any messages people would have for you, has your diet laid out, if there's an app for that, you know. And then you say, I'd like to catch up on what happened in yesterday's news. And you hit a button, and there's a news report from whatever app you like. Oh, I think I'll get CNN's report. No, I prefer Fox. No, I think I'll... And suddenly there's video. I mean, and that's just the first, you know, hour of your morning. That's before you microwave your breakfast, which was in your refrigerator staying cool. And you took great advantage of indoor plumbing. Oh, it's wonderful to be alive. after all the work done. We deserve no credit for it, mind you. I mean, nobody in this generation can say, aren't we great? We'll get to that in a future. That's a different message for a different day. But the goofy arrogance of people to think, because we have iPhones, we're better than people in the past. You didn't do anything to make that. You just shelled out the money for it. No, the work was done long before you. So let's not pretend that we somehow aren't part of this. We love it. And by the way, that's just the technology. That's just the stuff about that has to do with convenience. Really, there are important things about health. I mean, just the infant mortality rate and the lifespan. I mean, you could have been born in different times where life was a lot harder, where every day's work involved more toil, way less convenience, a lot more waiting around for things, a lot of things not available to you, a lot of things unaffordable to you, a lot of things not yet invented so you don't get to have them. I can't imagine what the average person would do if they jumped in a time machine and got dropped off in 1750. I don't know if we'd make it a week. You'd have nothing you would depend on and rely on. You would think, oh, this is just a living hell. How did they do it? But see, if they jumped in the time machine and came here, they might keel over from just sheer mind-boggling wonder. As they looked around, they'd say, holy smokes, what is this? They wouldn't just be out of... It's funny when people predict the future. They can't... We're not that good at... You ever notice that every time people predict the future, they're really hung up on flying cars? That's always the thing. Even go back 25 years when they're predicting now. It's always the flying cars, and yet that's the one thing we're light years from doing. We're a long way from flying. We're testing self-driving cars. That's been okay, but iffy. But flying cars. Every movie that predicted the time now, that's the one thing they had in common. They were all sure. If they were sure of one thing, it would be flying around in cars. And yet, everything else we've got, that's the one thing. We're nowhere near it. I think the military has something like some kind of hovercraft, but you don't see them a lot being used. I think that's still not exactly just out there everywhere in abundance. So, my second statement then, briefly here, was that science then is the fruit of Christian civilization. This will often come as a surprise to a lot of people today in a secularized world. There's an idea today. It's not exactly the thing we're looking at, which is that science is the be-all and the end-all, it can solve our problems. But it's related to it, and that is that thank God, as it were, or in most cases, whatever, if there is a God, they would say, but we should be happy and thankful for this wonderful advancement and progression beyond religion and towards secularism, because that helped us become more scientific, because religion is anti-science. We'll get to that next time in my other statement, that science is not incompatible. However, it plays a role here because there is the thought pattern that once society was very, very, very religious, and then we got over that and we got all scientific, and woo-hoo, science took off. And this couldn't be more wrong. It shouldn't be absolutely more false by any historical study. And so, once upon a time then in the Western world, you see, there was what we would see now is the foundations for what we all enjoy and are impressed by. The foundations of modern science were cultivated. Strides were made long, long ago. You know, it was Newton talked about, Newton considered arguably one of the greatest scientists and mathematicians, if not the greatest. He sort of humbly said, you know, I only saw further because I was sitting on the shoulders of giants. You've heard this quote. I was able to see further only because I sat on those shoulders. But he's right, you see. Now, he had his natural given gifts of just, you know, just a mind that's a rare and beautiful mind. However, he did have the great benefit, and he knew it, of a lot of other good minds who had passed their knowledge on. So you see, you're born like, it's like a race, but it's a long, long, long relay race. And let's say you're like getting the baton and you're the 58th person. Well, it kind of matters how the first 58 did, because that's where you're starting. And they didn't all do the same all around the world. Lots of civilizations. But the people are just as bright. Why didn't they cultivate science? It's not because of some inherent superiority. It's because of theology. It's because of worldview. It's because of the dominant beliefs led people toward the initial beginnings of discovery. This is a well-kept secret. Some historians have written clearly on this and know a lot about it. One guy who's pretty accessible is Rodney Stark from Baylor. If you ever want to read something that is put in paperback, and you know, it's not reading for kids or anything. I mean, it's still at a high enough level, but he means them as a popular level. Rodney Stark has written several books on this. What he does is he reads all these other books that are a little more scholarly, and he condenses them. And writes books about it. So, what about the great pioneers of all the sciences, those on whose shoulders all the scientists of today exist? Let me give you some of the just specifics. I wonder if you'd be surprised at some of these names you certainly will recognize, but all of these having in common that they shared a worldview very much like ours. Not the raging anti-religious atheist types you might assume, all those scientists were against the theologians and against the churches and against... No. They were believers now of one stripe or another. They would differ in their details and maybe some of their doctrines, doctrinal specifics and backgrounds. But all of them similar in the worldview. So, for example, Nicholas Copernicus, major groundbreaker, shocked the world with his suggestion that the earth is not in the middle of the solar system with the sun moving around it. Charles Babbage, creator of the computer, as we would say. Sir Francis Bacon, who first articulated the kind of scientific method much like we now enshrine in our schools. Robert Boyle, one of the early pioneers of modern chemistry. Galileo, don't even need that last name, do you? Galileo. No, don't do it, Jim. John Dalton, father of modern atomic theory. How about the great archaeologist W.F. Albright? Or you get some French guys, Jean-Henri Fabre, like Brett Favre, only Fabre, founder of modern entomology for you bug lovers, or the other Frenchman, Louis Pasteur, right? He formulated a germ theory of disease. There was the great archaeologist William Mitchell Ramsay, the aforementioned Max Planck, quantum theory and so on. Michael Faraday, founder of electromagnetic induction and field theory. How about Kelvin? Man's name you learned in chemistry, thermodynamics. Leibniz was a philosopher, but also the co-inventor of calculus, along with Newton. James Clerk Maxwell, the electromagnetic theory of light. Gregor Mendel, the monk, right, who discovered genetics as we know it. Kepler, another great astronomer. Samuel Morse, inventor of the telegraph, i.e. Morse code. Blaise Pascal, another Frenchman, great mathematician. There are others. People would be quite surprised, I think, quite surprised to know just the sheer predominance among the greatest minds in the past because of this idea today that, well, to be a real true scientist, you should probably not be very religious because you can't be a good scientist. There are those in our culture who say that pretty loudly today. You can't be devoutly religious in any way and be a great scientist. I mean, those two things are incompatible. We'll tell that to all of the great pioneers whose work you've benefited from. Could you do what you do now were it not for all of them? I got a quote for you. Here's a quote, and it'll sound a little harsh, but let me just give it to you. They're not my words. Quote, "Atheism is so senseless and odious to mankind that it never had many who profess it. Can it be by accident that," and then I'll spare you the lengthy version, basically a long description of all the details of the natural world that are remarkably complex and specified and seem designed for all the world. And then the end of the quote. "These many examples and such like considerations have always and ever will prevail with mankind to believe that there is a being who made all things and has all things in his power and who is therefore to be feared." Those, the words of no preacher per se, those the words of a man whose name I already mentioned, one Sir Isaac Newton. Okay, arguably one of the greats of all time. How could he say such things? Clearly the early scientists were, very obviously they were not fools, were they? They were no dopes and dummies. But you know what, for that matter, neither were all the great poets. Neither were all the great craftsmen or the government officials or the clergy. None of them were a bunch of dummies and fools. They were human beings. They were perfectly smart, capable, bright people. Many of them more insightful than many of us. You know what, for that matter, neither were just the average people, just the peasants. They were perfectly smart, capable people too. They weren't a bunch of morons. Neither were the Bible writers. Some people think, well, you know, it was easy to have all these religious beliefs before the age of science. Why, they just so gullible, they believe anything. They just thought all the world was just a bunch of magic. They didn't understand, so they easily accept miracles. As if they didn't know what natural laws were. As if they hadn't spent a lifetime learning by induction the way things work. That the world has laws and principles by which it normally works. And that strange, miraculous events were rare and awe-inspiring. They were anomalies. They often doubted them too. Just like we doubt them. They're hard to believe. They lived their lives. When an axe head floats, they didn't go, well, you know, who knows? Sometimes that sort of thing may happen. Because I'm such a dope, I don't know what floats and what sinks. I don't know nothing about no science. No. They see an axe head float, they'd say, whoa, that is weird. That is way out there. I may be dreaming. This may be a hallucination. Or there's some miracle at work here. See, the way that they understood it, biblical times and most of up until relatively modern times, was that the world is patterned. The physical world obeys laws because it has a legislator. There is a lawgiver. The giver of the moral law is also the maker of the physical laws. He has set the world into motion, and it operates according to rules and laws, and we respect them. But because we do not worship nature and venerate it and think that it's divine itself, we are free to exploit. We do not abuse. We are stewards. But we are free to investigate, to look deeply into it, to try to figure it out, to see if we can't solve some of the problems. Because God has nothing to hide. He says, go ahead. You want to go ahead and try to split an atom? Have at it. You will learn to respect nature in its raw power, but I'm not going to bar you from looking into it unless or until you're crossing moral boundaries of some kind. That's why we have to ask ethical questions about these things. However, the fact is, the biblical writers are no different. To them, there's an established pattern, the way things work, but God is free, if He so chooses, at any time, to do as He pleases. He's not bound by those rules. I can't make the axe head float. I can't make it rain if I want. I can't cause violations in these regularities. I can't say, you know, tomorrow I'd like the sun to be checkered purple and hot pink. And I'd like it to, you know, I'd like the snowfall in July to be, you know, fluorescent. That'd be cool. I think I'll do that. I can't do that. I have no control over those things. But if God is the all-powerful creator of those things, could He do that? Sure He could. He could do anything that's not logically absurd. And therefore, miracles are suddenly possible. Not that that means they're happening all the time around every corner and I expect six of them a day. They're still rare. That's why the crowds were always amazed when Jesus did things. And the life and ministry of Jesus represents the most condensed period of miraculous events probably ever in world history. That is the frequency of miracles. And when Jesus did those things, people were still amazed. You think when He turned water into wine, they just said, we're at a pre-scientific age, so we won't bat an eyelash at that. No, they thought, what? That doesn't happen. How does a guy do that? Even one of Jesus' own inner circle, when He was back from the dead, just couldn't believe it. What did He want? He wanted some of that empirical proof. Good old Thomas was like your hard scientific skeptic. I must have the empirical truth. And God was gracious so that Jesus supplied him with it. But he said, you know what? Blessed are those who will trust me beyond empirical proof. I don't have to come down in the flesh, walk in their kitchen and say, okay, look, it's really me. I really exist. Here I am. Come on over here. Put your hands right here. See? Blessed are those who I don't have to give them the most basic, fundamental, empirical proof of every little thing. But it shows you, though, that Thomas wasn't much different than we are as far back as he lived. We come back then to the cross-examination of Job, where we began. Do we believe that God really sits enthroned, that He reigns really supreme, even over the physical world? If that is so, then we, even as we or others, tirelessly examine all the complexities of the physical world, try to unlock its mysteries as we can, to try to get it to yield things for us, we remember our place all the more. We remember just how little we actually know. We don't get on our high horse and think, oh, the future is bright and the problems are solved because we have a scientific methodology. We will fix it all. Yes, yes, we know some things they didn't know. Okay. But as Job was reminded, look, can you make it rain? We still can't quite even predict the weather. And we got all kinds of instruments. But you know, the season in which we're living now reminds us, you better keep your head on a swivel when the old wall cloud appears. Right? You better be keeping one eyeball on the western skies, because we still can't predict. There's still so many things we can't do. And of course, even as God told Job, even your own perception, even the mind that you have that is able to do these things, you owe that to me. He has made everything beautiful in its time, but as Ecclesiastes says, we can't discover the most profound mysteries of all time and all of eternity.
That whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, you know, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and every man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.